It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 99 for Friday, the 2nd of November, 2012. This week, we're back in the studio for just one more week before a very special 100th episode. More about that coming up. And we're going to learn today about why the UK's new 4G network has got a lot of people crying in the streets. We're also going to learn about how shooting paintballs at asteroids is a good idea, and we'll play Halo 4 and tell you how amazing it is. All that and hundreds of more excellent words coming up. Ahoy hoy, Nick Langston back in the Trinket Cupboard. Joining me, of course, Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
And David Cornish.
Oh, hi.
Hey, David.
Hey.
Oh, hi.
Oh, hi.
Now, Liv, it feels weird being back in here, in our cupboard of tricks.
Yes, well, after all of 1 week out of the cupboard of tricks.
It feels like a while, though.
We got used to the liberty, didn't we?
For any new listeners, we did our very first live in front of a studio audience show last week at Wired 2012 with Lily Cole and David Karp. And it was, I don't know, David, you weren't on the show, you were watching it.
No,
was it
good? I was in the audience. It was really wonderful.
It was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we are going to be doing a very live, a very special live show next week, in fact, for our 100th episode. We're going to have an audience there.
Yeah.
We're going to have some drinks, going to have some fun.
It's going to be excellent.
It's amazing to think that it was 2 years ago now that we started doing this podcast.
I know.
Still haven't published the first episode.
No.
Still probably shan't.
Still pleased that we have not published the first episode.
No.
I want to know what happens. Is there some awful deadly secret that should never be revealed?
No. It was me. Were you on it, Liv?
I was on it, yeah. But I had never ever done a podcast before, whereas Nate had a lot of experience and Duncan had also done a bit of radio at uni. So it
and
was...
I think old Chris Finnemore was on the show.
Yes.
Sort of Wired veteran.
Yes.
From back in the day.
And we recorded it in the boardroom. It was all echoey and it was a strange experience. But maybe you want to refer to when we do our 100th episode.
Perhaps. We will see. Anyway, we've got a whole great show coming up between then and now. So let's get on with it. I want to talk about 4G first. Britain's first 4G network launched this week under the brand EE. Still a silly name, if you ask me. Which is a sister network to Orange and T-Mobile, because all three of these companies are operated by the same parent company. EE promises speeds up to 5 times faster than the 3G you currently have on your phone for downloading emails and websites and things. And 11 cities have got it, including London, Glasgow, Manchester, Sheffield, and Leeds. There are a few more. Now, this is a great bit of tech. I've had a 4G phone for a few days now. I've been trying it out. I've got download speeds of about 40 megabits per second. So that's about 4 megabytes a second, or just under one, say, iTunes song per second in terms of download speed.
That's just showing off.
And you were getting very excited about that, showing me your dashboard.
I did.
Yesterday.
I did a speed test and I showed Liv, who sits next to me in the office, and said, "Look at that." And Liv went, "Wow." And I went, "I know."
Yeah.
That's what all the ladies say.
The problem is that it's going to be quite expensive. So the network launched this week. Contracts start at £36 a month, which might not sound that much when you think that you get unlimited calls and unlimited texts. But you only, on that contract, get 500 megabytes of data, which, frankly, seems pitifully small.
I mean, that is standard across all networks in terms of the kind of general data allowance, isn't it? That's what they've kind of, all of them have seemed to have agreed to cap it at.
Well,
in terms of standard offerings.
I spoke to Mark Alera, who's a chief sales officer at EE, and he was defending the pricing structure. He said, quote, "The vast majority of our customers are using less than 500 megabytes of data per month today on Orange. And even on unlimited plans, customers are only using around a gigabyte. So our packages start at 500. And for the vast majority of our customers, that's more than enough." And I wrote a piece this week to kind of against this pricing policy, and that's where that quote was from. He was defending their stance, really. And I think at the moment 500 megabytes of data is probably enough for people on 3G, you know, but that's not why people are going to want to be using 4G, because it's significantly faster. Mm. They're going to want to be able to do more with that network. They're not going to want to be held to the same caps and usage limits that they've been used to on 3G for the last few years.
Yeah.
And for me, in my position, I'm not very happy with the network I'm on at the moment. I was looking to switch and I would pay 36 quid a month. I don't mind that. But for unlimited data, or for, yeah, you know, something like, you know, 5 or 6 gig or something like that, maybe more reasonable.
Yeah.
What do you think, David? Would you jump for this?
I personally wouldn't. I think that's a misuse of his own statistics there. He's saying that the average for Orange is 500 megabytes. Now, clearly the people who are going to want to jump on 4G are going to be the people who want to be downloading a lot more things. So for him to try and defend himself by saying, oh, the average will be fine with this new system, I don't think he seems to have missed the point as to what amazing new technology they're trying to offer. They're not going to be able to give it to the people who really are going to want to use it very early on.
But I guess they'd argue that at the moment they've got this premium product that no one else has on offer. So while they can, they should exploit this competitive advantage they have and exploit their customers by charging more for this extra speeds.
And I think that what this is not that the prices are unfair by current network standards. I think,
no,
you know, for a 2-year contract, get a phone, 36 quid a month. I don't think that's unreasonable. The problem is that it's unreasonable when you think, well, people are going to be doing this to get onto the 4G network and to start using more data. And, you know, if you just think about, well, I'm standing on a train station, my train's, say, 20 minutes late, I'm going to download a TV show from the BBC iPlayer. A 1-hour show from the iPlayer, even at average quality, is probably going to eat about 3/4 of your monthly allowance.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing I think people are going to want to do on 4G.
Yeah.
The company has said that they are going to be giving all customers access to BT Wi-Fi hotspots around the country, which is great. And they've also got a bunch of perks they can take advantage of, like free movie downloads and access to music services and stuff like that. But the problem is that they are all sort of things to take away from the fact that you're not going to be able to do as much as you want on the 4G network, which frankly is the big sell here. So I think there's some work that needs to be done. I think that while EE has the monopoly on 4G in the UK, because the other networks, of course, can't launch 4G until next year, they were in a position to say, we're going to set the benchmark here. And I think they've set the benchmark very low. And I think that other networks next year will probably come out and say, well, listen, you guys have been, you know, not jumping on board 4G because of those prices. Hey, we've built our network and policies and whatever around what you want.
Yeah.
And I think that come 2013, we're going to see some fierce competition on this front.
But then people will be locked into their contracts on that, on the deals that they've gone for the next 12, 18, 24 months.
Well, is that our advice? Don't jump on these deals?
Well, I'd say that, but I can tell it's a bit more competitive, but I guess that some people can't wait. I mean, you've gone straight in there.
Well, I haven't. I've got a review handset that I've got for a week.
Oh.
Then I have to send it back. I just wanted to test the speed and actually see if it was any good. So I'm not keeping it and I won't be jumping. I pay for my contract on my current network and I won't be jumping to pay anyone else. So
okay.
I think that's a shame. Anyway, let's move on. David, I want to talk about George Lucas because he's sold out.
Yeah, he has. Well, he's been doing that for a while.
I was going to say, it's not the first time, is he? What's happened with Disney?
It's an even bigger sellout. On the 30th of October, Walt Disney Company announced that they have acquired Lucasfilm. That's George Lucas's film corporation. They've acquired it for £2.5 billion in cash and stock. The company, alongside this announcement, made the slightly more exciting announcement that it's actually now prepping Star Wars Episode 7 for release in 2015.
Devastating news.
I mean, is this really selling out? I mean, he got his $4 billion to sell off his company at the tail end of his magnificent career.
Yeah. Mm.
It makes a lot of sense, surely.
I think, yeah. And I wouldn't
and
be surprised.
Has he ever kept the morals, saying that he was never going to... Did he ever say that?
I just like to wind up George Lucas. Everyone likes to wind up George Lucas.
Everyone does, and I think he's more than in for it. I mean, the latest set of Star Wars 3D releases, I think, are the most obvious example of him flogging an already very dead donkey.
Yeah.
He is trying to squeeze out as much money from a franchise that he's done very well with. He's has
all
right.
$4 billion is nothing to be sniffed at.
Exactly.
I'm sorry.
No, I agree. Okay, but this means that Disney is now in charge of the Star Wars franchise, and they've done good things with that in the past. Didn't they work with Marvel? Was it Marvel they did stuff with?
They have. Disney, yeah, so Disney's chairman, Robert Iger, has said that in buying Lucas, this is the same sort of thing that they did with the Marvel acquisition. So in 2008, they bought Marvel for almost exactly the same price, $4 billion. And since then, like Marvel, when they were bought, they had just released Iron Man, and everyone was, you know, slightly worried, are Disney going to now screw up the whole transition into the Marvel Avengers storyline that's coming out? And they didn't. They've done incredibly well with it. Iron Man 2 did very well. Thor was a very good film, I thought. Captain America was a bit bogus, but everybody loved the Avengers. It's made an absolute packet. So there is hope to be had, I think, in the way that Disney have handled that merger.
A new hope.
A new hope, you could say. You could, but you probably shouldn't.
No. And it's also been revealed today, I think, that George Lucas is going to be putting this money towards his education charity. So again, I think it's hard to complain about this.
I will retract 10% of my snidiness towards George Lucas. No, yes. I mean, I think he's going to have his hand still. I think he's going to be like a creative director. They're going to do these three more Star Wars films starting in 2015. And I think he is going to have some sort of guidance. But he's basically in the hands of somebody else under the Disney brand.
Precisely.
So, interesting. We'll see what happens there. Liv, let's talk about Apple, because a lawyer has given it something of a slap on its corporate wrist this week.
Well, a judge. I mean, many of our listeners will know that Apple and Samsung have been kind of embroiled in this battle ever since Samsung launched its Galaxy tablet. Apple's been saying that Samsung copied the iPad, saying it's infringed its designs. But a judge ruled in July that although they were similar, it wasn't actually copyright infringement, partly because Samsung's tablet wasn't as cool as the iPad. Now, following the ruling, Apple was told that it had to A, take out different ads in lots of different newspapers and other publications, and B, it had to put a notice on its site making it clear that Samsung hadn't in fact copied Apple in order to correct this damaging impression. Now, last week, Apple put up a little statement, but it was very noticeably chippy. It was linked from its homepage on Apple's UK store. And it goes on very extensively about the initial ruling that Samsung's product weren't as cool as Apple's iPad. And then it also made a point that although UK courts did not find Samsung guilty of infringement, lots of other courts did. Now, the Court of Appeal's not happy with this. It thinks that Apple's done a kind of half-assed effort. And it says that it's in breach of the order that it initially made. So Apple's been told it has to change this notice within 48 hours. But for me, the most ridiculous thing was that Apple actually said that they needed 14 days to change the statement on their own website, which for a company like Apple, it seems a little bit ridiculous.
Yeah. And the judge has said that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think demanded to know what is it exactly that's preventing you from doing this.
What is it from? He said, I would like to see the head of Apple make a legal statement setting out the technical difficulties, which means Apple can't put this on their website. This is Apple. They cannot put something on their website. ? So I think, I mean, everyone's recognizing that Apple's kind of gone about this in a slightly sniffy way.
Well, I know that Apple's lawyer said that the whole point here wasn't to try and make Apple grovel, but was to just simply spell out the ruling and was more of a just to try and make sure that there was no confusion in the marketplace.
Yes.
As opposed to humiliating Apple and make it apologize on its homepage, you know. I mean, I think what Apple did in this with its, it wasn't an apology, it was an acknowledgement and then some other words.
Yeah.
But I think it's kind of like the equivalent of being in school and being told to share your sweets and saying, okay, all right, I'll share my sweets. And then you sneeze on them first. And you say, there you go, have my sweets.
Yeah, I mean, it could have made the same statement in about one paragraph, and it did it over five lengthy paragraphs, really languishing in the idea that it was cooler than Samsung's. The iPad was cooler than Samsung. I think, I mean, it makes sense. And so we're going to see a new statement in the next, I think it was 48 hours, actually, they settled on.
Be one to watch. I think Apple, it's worked against Apple here. I think Apple probably realistically should have just done whatever was required and let it blow over.
Yeah.
Because all that this has done is kind of like when, you know, you get people like the you know, the MPAA or whatever claiming a victory over taking down the Pirate Bay. All that happens is that people write so much news story and coverage and analysis around it that it just promotes the sites more than it actually inhibits their growth. And I think this has just drawn more and more attention to Apple in a way that it probably doesn't want or will benefit from. But it'll be interesting to see what we see in 48 hours. I think from the time this was published, that should be late Friday maybe or early Saturday morning. So check your local Apple website and see what's there. And I know they're also going to be having to take out ads in some newspapers, Financial Times, I think.
Yes, T3. Daily Mail, T3. I think there's a couple of others as well.
So watch out for those. I like as well how they have to use a minimum font size of 11 point.
Yeah.
You know, so they can't get away with putting it in like 1 point and in all white on a white background. Yeah. So you have to highlight it to read it. Okay, David, let's go back to you. There is a solar-powered nation, a specifically 100% solar-powered nation, the first on the good Earth planet we do call our home.
There is. They are the Toklao nation.
This did crazy traffic on our site this week. Really popular story.
People were very excited to hear about it, and rightly so. So yeah, the Toklao, a tiny collection of astols, or coral islands.
Atolls,
which are coral islands in the South Pacific. Yet they've become the first nation, as you say, in the world to become powered entirely by solar energy, which is very cool. So they now have a network consisting of 4,032 solar panels and 1,344 batteries, which is providing them all of their solar energy.
I don't want to put, a poo in the pie here, but they do only have a 1,411 population.
They do.
And they are in the South Pacific, where there's a lot of sun.
That's a great number. That's the exact kilobit per second rate of an uncompressed CD audio file.
Hello.
Wow.
I know. I love it when stuff like that happens. So they haven't got many people, and so it doesn't seem that difficult for them to sort of be entirely off the grid.
No, but it's an issue which is all the more it's more important for them than it would be for many other nations in the world. This is a nation which the highest point of their island, which is above water, highest point is only 5 meters. So this is a nation which, as such, when you've got China and the US and a lot of European nations chucking out a lot of greenhouse emissions, and they don't really seem to be doing as much about it as they could. Apparently the UK only actually gets 6% of its energy in renewable sources.
Wow, we suck.
We really do.
So a little bit of sea level rise, they're going to be in serious trouble.
They really are. They're already in a little bit of trouble because their water reserves have already been contaminated by seawater just by even incremental rises in sea level. They're already running out of stuff they can drink. So at least they're setting the precedent. At least it gives them a PR spin, just something that puts them on the map, gets the news out there that, you know, there are nations that are going to be affected by climate change and by sea level rises. And as such, they are doing their bit, at least.
It puts them on the map before they disappear from the map.
Yeah. It's a good bit of PR, I think, as you say, because I hadn't heard of this particular nation before.
No.
And
Where is it? It's affiliated with New Zealand, isn't
it? It is. It's quite a few miles north of New Zealand. Really, like, slap bang in the middle of the Pacific. They're tiny, teeny, teeny, tiny, three little coral islands. They have a relationship with New Zealand in the same way that the UK has with the Channel Islands. And they're actually attempting to move toward an eventual state of free association. So they are able to govern themselves domestically, but they leave all the big international representation to New Zealand because they've got more time for that kind of thing.
I'm surprised the Pirate Bay hasn't tried to set up there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With their 100% solar powered servers.
Well, one of the apparently in their last the amount of money they were making from their TK domain took up 6% of their income, apparently.
Wow.
Yeah.
Think of all the hosting they're going to have put up with all this press.
Yeah.
All this PR.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on very quickly. Just before we get to our ad break, I want to talk about shooting paintballs at asteroids, because this is a recurring theme on the podcast. We talk about excellent ways to deflect incoming death from above objects, from lasers to, you know, gravity and all this kind of
grabbing
stuff.
Grabbing devices.
Now it's been suggested that we should be shooting them with paintballs.
Yes.
Is that like, I was going to say, is that like sort of shooting a cat off your lawn with paintballs? I suppose it is a bit.
A less cruel way of doing it. I mean, we're not talking about the kind of paintballing you might do on a stag do or a hen do. But this is like a slightly more heavy duty. This is an MIT aeronautics and astronautics graduate student, Sung-Wook Peck, I think you say it. And he's developed an innovative way to deflect asteroids heading to Earth and this is a kind of two-part solution. So the first involves taking enormous pellets of paint and volleying them to both sides of the asteroid in question from a nearby spacecraft that obviously you've taken to the asteroid as well. And then the force of the pellets would slightly push the asteroid off course initially. And then secondly, the paint would be white. And when the asteroids are now painted white, the surface would have double the reflecting power of the asteroid, its albedo. And this means that the solar radiation would cause it to be nudged even further away from its trajectory, thus avoiding Earth.
And he said that a 27 gigaton asteroid could be deflected with just, well, he says just 5 tons of paint.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is just 5 tons of paint and getting that into orbit is an extremely expensive.
Of course it is.
Mission.
But if we're, I mean, I guess it's the relative size, the 27 gigatons versus 5 tons. It's a pretty, pretty small relatively. But again, yes, as you say, it's a huge amount to take up space. So perhaps we'll have to create it somewhere else, perhaps on the moon or, you know, Mars, and then carry it.
It'll be one for Richard Branson, you know.
Yeah.
Virgin Spaceballs. Space paint.
Have you seen Spaceballs? Great film.
No. Is that one of those cartoon ones?
No.
With Michael Jordan?
It's like an old kind of late 80s, early 90s sci-fi spoof.
Of Star Wars, they've got lightsaber ring things.
Really?
Yeah.
Amazeballs.
Yeah. It is amazeballs.
Well, let's shoot paintballs at the first half of the show and transition into a break. But when we come back, we're going to talk all about the little tiny cute iPad mini.
Wired magazine, published digitally every month on iPad. Now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
Welcome back. This week, and today in fact, if you're listening on Friday the 2nd of November, Apple has released an iPad that is 8 inches diagonally. The iPad mini, it is in fact called. And what is interesting about this is that Steve Jobs famously ranted on an investor call about how bad 7-inch tablets were as a form factor. And in fact, I've looked up a clip from this investor call from a few years ago, and this is what Steve had to say on the topic.
We think the current crop of 7-inch tablets are going to be DOA, dead on arrival.
So it seems like Apple's made a bit of an about turn in the sort of post-Jobs era. We've gone from saying that it's no good as a tablet experience and that it's a tiny fraction of the screen real estate you get on the regular iPad to them releasing a 7.9-inch tablet. I suppose this is actually closer to 8 inches than 7, and suppose technically, this doesn't go against Jobs' rant. But I mean, the thing about Steve Jobs is that he had a tendency to say something was rubbish and it would, you know, who wants to watch TV shows on a little iPod screen? And then, you know, a few months later comes out with the iPod video and puts TV shows on your little iPod screen. And given the product life cycle and development time that Apple's products take, and we're talking years here, not months, it's highly likely that this product was in development and had the hands of Jobs on it long before he passed away. So, you know, for whatever reason we put to this, they've had an about turn on the public. And what the public thinks, Apple thinks about 7-inch tablets. Anyway, this is, on the inside, it's got an A5 processor, which is the same processor that's in the iPad 2, the non-Retina iPad, that is. It's got a 1024 by 768 pixel screen, again, like the iPad 2, although slightly smaller, so it's slightly crisper on the screen than the iPad 2 was. It weighs 308 grams, which is a lot lighter than the iPads, and it's got 16 gig of storage and above, and will start at £269, which frankly seems, you know, quite expensive considering the competition that's out there at the moment.
Yeah, because it's going to be taking on the Amazon Kindle Fire, isn't it?
Yeah, and Amazon's actually taken great joy in promoting the differences and values of the Kindle Fire to the extent of, on the US homepage, having a comparison, side-by-side comparison, the iPad mini versus the Kindle Fire with all the specs next to each other, and a quote from Gizmodo that said it was ballsy. I mean, Amazon really has tongue-in-cheek gone after them on this. But I have to say, I you know, the iPad mini is a lovely device. It's very, very nice. But the Kindle Fire costs about £100 less. It's got a higher resolution screen, even though the screen is ever so slightly smaller by 0.9 inches. And obviously ties into Amazon's ecosystem in a similar way to how Apple's ties in. They're still very two different devices. And frankly, I don't think they compete as closely together as, say, the iPad mini and the Google Nexus 7 tablet does, which we'll come to in a second, because the Kindle really feels much more about, you know, it's about reading books and it's about listening to audiobooks and playing videos and streaming from the Amazon store, whereas the iPad is about that, but it's also about, you know, productivity and, you know, better web browsing, and it does have a better browser and things like this. So they're not directly in competition. But the Google Nexus 7, which is Google's sort of flagship 7-inch Android tablet, only costs £159. That's £110 less. Mm. That's a 7-inch tablet. Again, higher resolution screen, even though it's slightly smaller. Quad-core processor. And, you know, frankly offers, you know, blow by blow, probably the same sort of stuff from the Google world that the iPad mini offers from Apple's world. Yeah. You have to think, with this on the market, has Apple overpriced this thing?
Mm.
Because there's nothing radically new that this is bringing. It's more like, you know, a lot of the other players in the market have been playing catch up to Apple's 10-inch while developing their own 7-inch. And now Apple, it feels a little bit like he's saying, okay, we get it. You want 7-inch tablets. Here's a 7-inch iPad that's basically a shrunken down iPad 2 while everyone else is really competing with the iPad 3.
See, I feel it perhaps not going after the competition in terms of, you know, the other 7-inch tablets. It could just be the people who just want to have an iPad regardless, but they can't afford the bigger iPad. This will capture some of that market, I think. Yeah. I don't know if, the size is obviously a consideration as well, but if it's some people just want Apple or nothing, and this will help like scoop up some of the extra people who want Apple devices but don't necessarily want to fork out £500.
David, do you have an iPad?
I don't know. I merely have the phone.
You have the iPhone, okay. And if you were to go into an Apple store, say you wanted a tablet, what tablet would you be looking for? What would you buy?
At the moment, I'm swaying far more towards either the Nexus or the Kindle Fire. Simply because I have my iPhone is my link into the Apple world. I get to use all the iOS stuff. I get to get the games that I want. And if I wanted to have another device now, I don't want to spend money on an Apple product, because as we say, like, Apple are able to get away with putting that extra £100 on their price tag merely by the virtue of you get the shiny Apple logo, you have a piece of tech that is designed very nicely, but beyond that, I don't know why I get to pay that much more money for it.
It is the luxury 7-inch.
Yeah.
It's definitely the luxury, and it's got that value to it. I mean, I agree with you, Liv, and I think this is going to sell like hotcakes. I really do. I think it's going to sell. It's going to sell millions. It's got that price point for, you know, the, you know, maybe slightly higher income households to put this in a kind of stocking in the same way that they would.
This is a stocking filler?
Present.
I don't mean as a stocking filler. I mean kind of like in the same way they might think, well, I want to buy my son or daughter like a gaming thing. I'll buy them the iPad mini instead of the iPod Touch and things like that. And, you know, I think to a certain extent we might see iPod Touch sales slightly cannibalized as a result of the iPad mini.
Yeah.
And you know, I think it'll do great despite the price, because even as the price of a device, it's arguably quite an attractive price. It's only when you look at what else you could get for the money, you could say, well, I could save a bit of money and get, you know, something that's, you know, arguably as good. But that's always the case with Apple stuff.
Mm.
You know, you can, if you look at the specifications inside a MacBook, you can get a PC, a Windows PC, that has exactly the same performance, you know, for, you know, average use, but you don't get the same sort of, you know, luxury design and
smugness,
all that kind of stuff. So I think it'll be interesting to see how this sells, but no, I think I don't think the price is going to be limit adoption. But let us know what you think. podcast@wired.co.uk, of course. We'll have a full review on the site probably by the time you hear this, or certainly within a few days. We don't like to rush our reviews, do we, Liv?
No.
But take our time and actually spend some real hard finger time with our products before we publish our choice words. Last up, I want to talk about a game, probably one of the biggest game releases of the year, probably one of the biggest game franchises in Xbox history. So, well, certainly the biggest, I think, in Xbox history, alongside perhaps Grand Theft Auto, and probably one of the most important gaming franchises ever.
This is that's quite a lot of build-up.
Yeah.
this is Halo 4, which Halo started out on the Mac.
It did.
Believe that back in the day, Combat Evolved, and then moved over to Windows. So Halo 4 is coming out on the 6th of November. We're incredibly important people, so we've already had a copy for about a week or so. David, you've already played it.
I have.
You've finished it.
A lot, I have.
You've written a review and published it and gave it 9 out of 10.
I did indeed.
So I want to talk, what is Halo 4 precisely, and why should people listening give a damn?
Well, Halo 4 is the fourth installment of John 117's story. So the Master Chief, he has finished battling the Flood. He's done that bit. He saved the galaxy from that peril. And what he's now doing, this is the beginning of a new series called the Reclaimer Saga, or the Reclaimer series, which the studios, 343 Industries, who now handle the game, they say it's set to see Master Chief confront his own destiny and face an ancient evil that threatens the fate of the entire universe in that really cheeseball kind of a way. He's basically got some new bad guys to fight.
And 343 as a company is an interesting angle on this story because the last few games have been produced almost exclusively by Bungie.
They have, the original creators. Yeah.
Yeah, now not so much.
No, what happened was back in 2007, 343 came about to start handling the backstory of Halo. There was so much like stuff coming up, whether it was fan fiction or the Halo universe popped up. And Microsoft had acquired the intellectual property rights for the actual Halo franchise.
And there is a ton of backstory. I mean, there are novels, aren't there? Yeah. There's anime, there's all sorts of stuff.
There's a lot of things out there. So they did need people to start cataloguing it, really. And so 343 grew out of that into their very own Microsoft Game Studios developer. And they have slowly been taking over the reins, very gradually, from Bungie for their baby. And so they came in 2011, they took over on the Reach engine. Well, they basically started looking after the servers and the online and all that kind of stuff. They looked after that community. They were in charge of the Halo Combat Evolved Anniversary Edition that came out. Did a very good job with it. No major complaints from anybody. So this is their first standalone game. It's all theirs, all their very own. They've got some Bungie guys on board, but it's all them.
This is the guy. This is basically the guy who started off making tea for the director and he's now directing his own film.
Sort of,
but
yeah.
I mean, they're made by fans, right? So this is now in the hands of people who love Halo, and Halo fans have been quite receptive. You are a hardcore nut job when it comes to Halo. That's why you reviewed it instead of me.
Yeah.
And, you know, you seem to think they've done a good job, right?
I think they've handled it as well as they could have done. They have been very faithful to the original. There are lots of nods to the original games. Not in a cheesy way, just in a very... They know where their genes come from. They've been careful in the way they've handled it. And they've expanded it. They've given it a scope that former games were aiming at, but 343 have managed to give it. So I've been very impressed.
Good. And is it going to be accessible to people who've not played all the billions of other Halo games and read all the novels? And
possibly not. I mean, it is, to be fair to it, it is Halo 4. It isn't trying to be... It is following a series, so you do need to know a little bit of a backstory before you get thrown in there. Completely new players won't know what's going on, in the sense that...
Like Liv.
But you could watch the miniseries, which is what I watched the other day, and I was hooked after, I don't know, I think there was about 5 episodes, and it's a miniseries that introduces you to the kind of preamble before Halo 4 opens. So you could, without having to play all the other three, jump in at that point. They're like 6 minutes each episode, or 8 minutes, I think, and then dive straight in.
Yeah, the Halo Forward Unto Dawn miniseries has been very good at setting up some backstory. There's these things called the Halo 3 terminals. A lot of backstory was dropped into these hidden devices around the Halo 3 game. I would recommend that if before you buy it, go and read those terminals. It will take you probably about half an hour, and it will just give you a nice little backstory that will become very central to Halo 4.
Have we got these on the site?
No, but we can do.
Why not? Why have we not got these on the site?
Well, I didn't want to...
Stop slacking.
I know, sorry. Okay, they shall be dropped into the Halo 4 review. So please do, go and have a look at the Halo 4 review, read up on the Halo 3 terminals, and you'll be set and ready to go.
Yeah, and if you've missed anything, email David and say, stop slacking. I want more Halo content, more. When's it out?
It's out on the 6th of November, next Tuesday. For most of the world, apart from any of our Japanese listeners, out on the 8th of November. Don't know why, but they've got to wait 2 days.
That sucks. One of the few things that sucks about Japan, then.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we did ask for a little bit of feedback from some of our colleagues, because it's not just been David and me who've been playing Halo 4, but one other guy, Ollie Franklin, who works for GQ, says it's awesome and much, much harder. He said it's harder. He said it's tough. Now, is he a pansy?
I think he's a pansy.
Does he have weak thumbs and a fragile mind?
This sounds like trash talk, but I mean, I'm going to go
he's
ahead
a very
and say
tall
that.
Man.
Is he right? Well, I've been playing through it on Legendary, and I haven't found it that bad.
Right, it's on.
It's on.
The gauntlet is down.
Wow.
The power glove has hit the floor, and it's exploded in a shockwave of challenges and fear. Okay.
Okay.
Let's wrap up the show, shall we, Liv? Tell people how they can get in touch.
As ever, you can catch us on Twitter. We're at Wired UK. We've also got a lovely Facebook page, facebook.com/WiredUK. And you can email us, podcast@wired.co.uk.
And I'll be shot in the head if I don't mention that we've got not one, but two new issues in the magazine out this week. Firstly, our December issue, which is probably the thickest issue I think we've ever done. It is absolutely jam-packed. Got some amazing features in there. It's bright and yellow. You cannot miss it. And it's got Rob Brydon on the front cover on a jetpack.
Yes, in a jetpack.
I mean, if that's not enough to tempt you, I don't honestly know what is. We've also got our guide to 2013, and that is a very special one-off issue of Wired, which if you don't normally read the magazine and don't subscribe or whatever, check it out. It's basically the guide to everything you need to know in the Wired world for 2013. I have to say, they've done a pretty good job, and all available on the usual tablet outlets as well, including now the Kindle Fire. That'll do it for us. We're back next week for a live episode from a very special place with some very special people drinking some very special beer. But more on that coming up. We'll see you then.
Bye.
Bye-bye. The Wired Could You Keep podcast, where we tell you you're wrong, why you're wrong.
And when you were wrong.
When you were wrong, and why we are right about you being wrong. Stop being wrong on the internet. There are people like us here to correct you.